to single sighting.
What is your question, General? Said Dominica evenly.
Forgive me, but I must ask you officially, as the Chief of Counterintelligence, are there any SVR recruitment operations in China?
Dominica kept her face shut down even as the thought boiled from the pit of her stomach, crept up her spine, and volleyed around the top of her head.
It's Nate, she thought. I'm sure of it, I can feel it. It's a false flag pitch. Benford's behind it, they're up to their old tricks, pitching a Chinese officer as a Russian. Thanks very much, fellas. You could have given me some warning, but that wouldn't have happened, not in a million years.
General, I can answer with complete honesty that there are no human SVR operations in China or against Chinese interests anywhere, said Dominica.
Technically, she was telling the truth. There were no ongoing human recruitment operations, but that did not include massive Russian SIGINT and LINT collection programs along China's northern border and far east Pacific coast. General Sun smiled. He was aware of the distinction and recognized the evasion.
I never thought so myself, he said, but I had to ask. Please excuse the presumption.
His yellow halo was steady.
But your counterintelligence problem remains, said Dominica. What are your next steps? With the most welcome confirmation that your service is not involved, we can proceed to investigate other possibilities, said the general. You have other leads to pursue?
The general leaned forward in his chair.
Yes, a particular possibility with which I believe you can assist. Several weeks ago, assets in Hong Kong reported the arrival of a CIA officer on a limited temporary assignment, somewhat unusual, coinciding with the approximate time frame of the shady contact between an unknown Chinese official and an unidentified Russian.
Bosh moi, my God, they're already looking at Nate, she thought.
Chinese counterintelligence is insidious. Keep fishing, you must learn as much as you can.
We have no information on this officer, said Sun. He apparently has never operated against the People's Republic, but I kindly request SVR traces in the event you have a file on him. Beijing would like to review his biography, operational history, and, most important, whether he speaks Russian.
Nate's Dalo Formular, the operational file, is 5 volumes. It will make the MSS swoon. Respond now, she thought. You have to agree, no other response is possible.
Of course, General, said Dominica. Please send me this American's name, and I will personally run full traces on him for your review.
Thank you, Colonel, said the General.
And what will be your course of action? Said Dominica.
Our priority, of course, is to identify the traitor. If the American CIA officer has indeed recruited an agent, he knows the name. Beijing has directed an asset to develop a relationship with the American to attempt to elicit the name of the turncoat.
It will not be easy, said Dominica. In my experience, the Americans are disciplined and cautious.
The ultimate irony, thought Dominica. 100 years ago, I was sent to elicit the name of Korchnoi from Nate. Look how that turned out.
Our operatives are very effective, he said. I have heard about your service and its methods, so I know you will understand. You are not the only ones who employ what I believe you call sparrows.
Sparrows, said Dominica, swallowing hard. They were effective in their day. Sexual attraction can be a powerful tool, but times have changed and methods have evolved over the years.
Most interesting, but our sparrows, we call them Zhenyao, are occasionally called upon to perform functions beyond mere seduction and coercion, said the general.
Dominica felt her foot bouncing.
Zhenyao translates as poison feather bird, said the general. Part of an ancient mythology.
What are you saying? Said Dominica.
Whether our operative is successful in eliciting the name of the mole from the CIA officer or not, his complicity is clear, said the general. She will be ordered to assassinate the American. She is highly trained in the requisite skills.
Wonderful. A Chinese female assassin running loose, a goddamn poison feather bird, whatever that is.
You know your procedures best, General, said Dominica casually, feeling her heartbeat behind her eyes.
She was gently trying to talk this down with no effect.
I might mention that we have long observed an unspoken rule that we do not offer violence against opposition officers. We view it as counterproductive and costly.
I understand. Sadly, the result of this policy of restraint did not, as we know, stave off the dissolution of the Soviet Union, a somber historical lesson noted by our own Politburo,
said the general, displaying uncharacteristic candor.
We believe that it is salutary, occasionally, to send a dramatic message to the enemy to deter future offensive action, especially inside China.
I am not convinced it is a wise course of action, said Dominica.
The general shrugged.
Beijing insists, he sniffed. But I would like to propose something a little out of the ordinary.
You have all my attention, said Dominica.
Would you consider coming to China, Hong Kong, to advise us on the counterintelligence phase, the entrapment of the operation against the American? Your service has many years of experience operating against America and Americans, especially CIA. We would look forward to your guidance and, of course, to exchanging methods and techniques. You would be the esteemed guest of the minister.
What was this, an intricate CI trap? Some way to link Nate and her, some triple move by Gorelikov to incriminate her? Don't be paranoid, your security is intact. These Chinese were devious and intricate, but they're not stupid. A rare invitation to China to observe MSS operations would be a triumph. Putin would marvel at her acumen and skill. No senior SVR officer had ever before been invited to monitor an ongoing, compartmented activity.
This is indeed an extraordinary request, she said. It would be fascinating to share observations and techniques, with the caveat that I do not wish to be party to any lethal operation.
We can accommodate you with great pleasure, said the general, glowing yellow.
It was unclear whether he meant MSS would shelve plans to assassinate Nate, or that she would be ushered out of the room before Miss Poison Pussy was let off her leash. Could she convince them to forego assassination?
I thank you for your kind invitation, said Dominica. It's an inspired idea, General Sun. I believe I can secure authorization from the director, I really mean from Putin, for this trip.
The general bowed his head.
I am delighted we will have the opportunity to host you, he said. There is some need for haste, however. Our operative has already made contact with the American. Would it be even remotely possible for you to fly to Beijing tomorrow? It is an 8-hour flight, with an additional 3 hours to Hong Kong from Beijing.
You've got no shrack. You put a hold on personal meets. Even if there were time for you to put down a note, there wasn't. It would be days before a Moscow officer could get black and retrieve a message that Nate is a target and should be yanked out of Hong Kong immediately. If she knew him, Nate's probably trying to develop this Zhenyao.
Idiotka.
All you can do is go to Hong Kong and somehow try to warn Nate, or spoil the approach without burning yourself. She could not bear the thought of both Gable and Nate being taken away from her.
I will be ready tomorrow, said Dominica.
Dominica called the Kremlin. Gorelikov was delighted with the prospect of her Hong Kong trip, and said he would inform the president, who would also be greatly pleased at her remarkable progress. It was unprecedented that a senior SVR officer was even invited to China, much less asked to advise on an entrapment operation. Your specialty, crowed Gorelikov, to which Dominica silently told him to go to hell, and thought sadly of Ilana and all her sister sparrows.
The president just yesterday asked whether you liked your dacha at the Cape, said Gorelikov conversationally. He looked forward to taking you around the mansion to explain the restoration work and to show you the famous antiques of Tsar Alexander.
Dominica read the message. Her weekend at the dacha naturally was a matter of record, but her meanderings about the palace with the young Pole Andreas had been noticed. Cameras, bugs, or security, including their peeking into the master suite. She remembered now that Andreas had told her the ornate bed had belonged to Tsar Alexander. The end of the evening with Andreas in her dacha was presumably also known, but Dominica didn't care. Gable long ago had told her always to assume uncontrolled rooms were bugged, and that the best way to reassure the Watchers was to feign ignorance of the surveillance, demonstrating guileless innocence.
"Let them see you alone in bed," Gable had said, hands under the covers moaning, crashing the yogurt truck. "Give them a show." Dominica had pretended to be shocked, telling Gable Russian girls didn't do that.
"Probably why most of them got mustaches," he had said, and she had called him Nekulturny, laughing. How she missed him.
There was another component to the president's invitation. With the acuity of a sparrow, she knew Putin would not hesitate to lead her into his capacious bedroom, dismiss his bodyguards, and determine whether his new director of SVR would follow any and all directions. What would she do? Benford would probably tell her there were no limits, that access was the ultimate goal. Gable would tell her to bring a tin snips with her and shorten the already diminutive president by a couple more inches. Nate would go red in the face, caught between duty and jealousy. Wise, experienced Forsythe would take her aside, hands on her shoulders, and advise her to tell Vladimir that if he wanted a sparrow, she would get him one, but if he wanted a chief of the Foreign Intelligence Service, there could be no thought of anything more. She'd kill for him, but she wouldn't share his bed. God knew what his reaction would be. It still didn't solve the problem of how to warn CIA that Nate was a target. Gable had once spoken to her about a doomsday option, a hypothetical situation in which Dominica found out about, say, an imminent Russian nuclear attack on the United States, the start of World War III, with no way to pass the intel. In that case, she was to flash her SVR colonel's credentials, shoulder her way past the FSB Militsia guard at the front gate of the U.S. Embassy, and get the information to the chief of station. It would burn her bridges, it would be the end of her spying and probably her life, but a crisis like that would be the threshold. But there was no time even to contemplate that. There was no time left. She had brooded all evening and was exhausted as she packed a small suitcase at home. Oh, she knew very well that a lone officer's life was expendable, including her own, in the grand scheme. She knew CIA would not equate the possible assassination of Nate with the start of World War III. Benford would say Diva's life was overwhelmingly more valuable and that the equities weren't even close. He would say Nash had to take his chances and she had to stay safe. Her legs shook. She was on her way to China to advise these MSS fanatics how to put Nate in a bottle with no way to save the man she loved. She couldn't watch him butchered. Couldn't see his blood spreading in a pool under his head. Being caught while warning him in Hong Kong would be tantamount to revealing everything to the MSS, and word would get back to Moscow. They would be waiting for her at Sheremetyevo when she returned, no longer the favored girl in the club, now a Predadel, a traitorous Judas. The panic was like a choking lump under her tongue, and her chest felt tight. The next morning, the black limo sighed up to the curb in front of Dominica's Moscow apartment. The door opened, and General Sun stepped out, resplendent in his formal uniform. For the first time, his yellow aura was pulsing, perhaps in expectation of returning to the Middle Kingdom, his homeland. The driver hurried to put Dominica's suitcase in the trunk.
"Well, Colonel," said the general, "are you ready for our most excellent adventure?"
He held the door open for her.
"I cannot tell you how excited I am," said Dominica.
Kompot, Russian fruit drink. Bring a large pot of water to a boil. Pit and slice apricots. Pit cherries, wash blueberries, and add fruit to water and boil uncovered until fruit has broken down. Remove from heat, add ample sugar to taste and let cool. Strain the juice and refrigerate. Serve chilled.
Chapter 28. The Tibetan Gong. "It's not bad," said COS Burns, putting his feet up on his desk. "You think you have enough time to do a proper developmental?"
"I don't know," said Nate. "Grace Gao all of a sudden got friendly, invited me to a guided tour of the hotel. Could be she's lonely, could be she's horny, though that doesn't seem right. And could be that undefinable something, life weariness. She's tired of the heavy hand of Beijing and the greasy breath of all the Asian millionaires looking for a pretty little concubine. Maybe she just wants to play on the American team, establish a little life insurance.
You have to be discreet, said Burns. We're on their home turf. There are a lot of eyes out there. You determine what's best, but I'd say move the contact out of the hotel as soon as is natural. Go to restaurants, go on a picnic, take the ferry to Lantau Island, and go kiss the big Buddha on the hill. Maybe she'll start talking about her faith.
Bunty Boothby says she's a level 3 yogini. It's the only other thing in her life besides the hotel. Burns scratched his head.
What the hell's a level 3 yogini?
I guess it's like a black belt in yoga. She's apparently very good, been studying it for years, with a body to show for it. If it's important to her, I can get her to share her yoga life with me. It'll be a strong assessment tool.
Burns looked sideways at him. Yeah, you just be careful with that assessment tool of yours. We're looking for a solid recruitment that'll last. I don't want you turning over a lovesick agent pining for Captain Picard when you leave Hong Kong.
Nate blinked twice.
Who's Captain Picard? Said Nate. The bald guy on Star Trek, with a head like a dick, said Burns.
You watch Star Trek? Said Nate.
Burns shook his head. My kids, 24 hours a day, drives me nuts, but the guy's head does look like the tip of a...
Bunty calls it a bell end.
Exactly, said Burns.
Okay, Chief, said Nate. I'll go in slow and careful. Besides, the Aussies think Grace may be a little out there, emotionally. I'm strictly playing it as a big brother, trying to identify what she needs out of life.
Well, play it smart, said Burns. Keep your eyes out for any swerves and watch your ass. If this clicks, she could be useful. My very first chief liked to say that every station needs 3 kinds of support assets. Someone who works in the best hotel in town, who can sneak you room keys for agent meetings and tell you when big shots are in town. A telephone lineman who can shinny up a pole and put a tap on a phone line, and a reliable recruited cabbie who can drive you around, do surveillance, deliver a package.
Chief, do they still have telephone linemen?
I heard it was all digital these days, said Nate, deadpan. He saw that Burns was suppressing a smile. I've got enough comedy talking to headquarters, he said. Bring me the master key to the Peninsula Hotel.
Nate was content to stay on in Hong Kong for a while to work the developmental of Grace Gao, especially if it meant avoiding the enveloping tar pit of Langley. He frequently wondered how Benford's mole hunt in Washington was progressing, especially since Diva's life hung in the balance, and part of him wanted to return to Langley to help in that effort. He would know soon enough if Grace was recruitable. He would see the signs of that metaphysical harmony between two people who think alike, have the same needs, and trust each other. The classic recruitment is when the case officer knows ahead of time that the agent's answer will be, "What took you so long?" when the officer delivers the pitch. The case officer looks for the sweet spot when two people are in sync, when a look between them is all that's required to communicate volumes. Grace was a stunning woman, but Nate knew he had to focus on her mind and her needs to become a friend and confidant, and to explore her eventual willingness to talk to American intelligence in a clandestine relationship about her hotel and its VIP guests. In an accelerated developmental, he had to press without pressuring. Gable once explained it as taking your time in a hurry. Benford had agreed to this extension of his TDY assignment, but it wouldn't last forever, and the recall order would come the instant forward progress on the case stalled. Grace met him at the front door of the hotel under the steel porte-cochere, emblazoned with the Peninsula in gold letters. A nervous knot of stewards in white coats and doormen in green livery stood at a respectful distance, wondering what the boss lady was doing outside, standing beside one of 2 snarling stone imperial guardian lions on either side of the front doors. The juxtaposition of Ms. Gao and the mythic statues was upsetting to the staff. Nate's taxi pulled up the circular drive lined with 6 forest green Rolls-Royce Phantom limousines in the hotel's luxury car fleet. Grace stepped forward to shake Nate's hand, and he almost tripped over the curbstone looking at her, a vision out of Shanghai in 1920. She was dressed in a fitted black Kipao Xiangsam that came to just above the knee, with a mandarin collar, capped sleeves, and scarlet Chinese knot buttons up the front. Only the traditional side slit was missing. Nate decided the dress had been sprayed on that morning because there was no way anyone could actually physically wriggle into it. She wore black pumps over sheer black nylons.
"Welcome back to the peninsula, Nathaniel," said Grace.
"Nathaniel?" The thought flitted through his mind that she somehow had researched his name. He'd told her his name was Nate. The assistant general manager of a 5-star hotel had to be resourceful. She followed his gaze as he looked at the line of gleaming motor cars.
"We're very proud of our fleet of Rolls," she said. "We have 14 of them. Come over here. I want to show you something."
She walked to the first limousine in line, triggering a rush by no fewer than 3 doormen to pull open the rear door of the limousine for her. Grace bent down and pushed a button recessed in the end of the door above the locking mechanism, and the handle of a silk umbrella popped out. She pulled it all the way out and flourished it.
"I'd open it to show you the peninsula name, but that would be bad luck."
She replaced the umbrella in the limousine door.
"Don't tell me you're superstitious," said Nate.
Grace just smiled, turned, and walked into the entrance lobby, patting one of the guardian lion statues on the head as she passed, looking over her shoulder at him.
"Maybe superstitious, but certainly playful."
Nate followed the dress and the sheer stockings into the hotel lobby. For the next hour, Grace led Nate on a fascinating tour of the venerable hotel, from the gleaming stainless steel kitchens and rooftop heliport to the infinity pool on the 8th floor. In the hushed wood-paneled VIP lounge on the top floor, Grace opened a photographic book documenting the peninsula's history. They stood shoulder to shoulder as Grace flipped the pages, pointing out interesting facts. Nate stole quick glances at her, watching as her eyes flittered across the photos, her eyelashes fluttering and her mouth pursed in concentration. She was wearing a hint of something lilac or lavender, and he could feel the heat from her arm through his jacket sleeve. She wore her hair in a bun, with 2 black lacquered chopsticks stuck through it. She stopped turning pages and caught him looking at her hair. Nate smiled at her.
"Your hair is very pretty that way," he said. "Not many American women wear it like that."
"A compliment. Mention the United States. Here's a man who's observant." She fingered the chopsticks self-consciously.
"I don't know why I wear it like this. They keep falling out," she said.
Neither of them said anything, and Nate kept quiet.
"How do you handle silence? What do you say?"
"Would you like to see the health club and spa?" said Grace. "It's on the 7th floor."
"Smooth recovery. Isn't easily flustered under control." The health club had the usual array of expensive machines arranged along floor-to-ceiling windows, with a soaring view of the harbor. The spa, sauna, and massage rooms were all magnificently appointed. As they walked around, Nate ruefully complained that it never seemed that he had enough time to exercise, time to raise yoga.
"What do you do to stay fit?" he asked.
"I practice yoga," said Grace.
"Been doing it long?"
Guileless question, on purpose. "Talk to me."
"Since I was a little girl," she said vaguely.
"Reluctance. She's not convinced I'm interested, so sell it." Nate had been reading up on yoga styles the night before. "I had a friend who did what I think she called Ashtanga yoga, is that right? And what's that hot yoga called, where they heat the room?"
Grace looked at him through her lashes, assessing his sincerity.
"Ask for information? Educate me."
"Yes, Ashtanga, Vinyasa, Bikram. These are modern styles and very popular," said Grace.
"What style do you practice?" asked Nate.
"An older style, something based on an ancient book," she said, looking at the floor.
"A sticking point. Gently now."
"What's it called?" said Nate.
Grace's eyes searched his, her China doll face, hesitant for a moment, then clearing with the decision to share.
"A book of Hindu verses called the Rigveda was written in 1500 BC. My yoga is based on that book. It is called Kundalini Yoga. It is now a popular style."
"I've never heard of it," said Nate. "What does it look like? Do you stand on your head?"
"Come on, set me straight." "It is a very strong style," she said, smiling thinly. "I do not want to bore you."
Nate shook his head. "I'm not bored," he said. "Tell me."
"It's the use of poses, chanting, and special breathing,
all three to release the energy in our bodies, Grace said. When our energy is blocked, we cannot grow. When we release it through the discipline of yoga, there is health and stability and peace. I know this sounds very mystical and silly, but it has helped me.
Nate nodded to a wood-floored exercise area surrounded by full-length mirrors.
Show me something I could learn without tearing my shoulder out of its socket, said Nate.
Grace looked at him skeptically. Nate slipped out of his shoes and held out his arms, the earnest foreigner who wanted to learn about her world.
All right, this is Adho Mukha Svanasana. It's relatively easy. I'll show you, then you try it.
She shucked off her heels, walked onto the wood, planted her feet, then bent forward and put her hands on the floor, walking them ahead of her until she was in a pike position, her hips in the air, her head lowered between her shoulders. Nate saw her triceps flexing, her stomach contracted into a wasp waist, and her thigh muscles rippled. A soft hissing note came from her mouth as she exhaled for what seemed like 10 seconds. Her fitted dress inched up her thighs, revealing the lacy tops of her stockings and in the mirror behind her, a glimpse of the black lace V of her panties.
Whoa, interesting. Is she oblivious or is she flirting? No way she's promiscuous.
Grace straightened up and motioned for Nate to try it. He put his hands on the floor and copied the pose as she had done it. Grace noted with satisfaction that Nate's form was very good and that he was strong. She was pleased that he had done it well. The first contact had gone well. Grace was friendly and modest, and she'd responded to Nate playing the informal, friendly American. She wasn't so tight-assed shy that she didn't demonstrate a yoga pose in a short skirt. Now comes the second meeting, thought Nate, a critical contact in any developmental when the target decides whether the relationship continues. Embroidered stocking tops and pink grapefruit lips aside, Nate hoped it would. 3 days later, Nate invited Grace to dinner. She knew Hong Kong and suggested they go to the China Club, a chic restaurant done in colonial Shanghai style, with red walls and Chinese screens, an ornate carpeted staircase to the dining room, and funky framed daguerreotypes of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao on the walls, a tongue-in-cheek retro pantheon of the crew who plunged the world into flames. The club was on the top 3 floors of the Old Bank of China building, the first post-war skyscraper in then-British Hong Kong, with a 1950s vintage lobby of polished marble columns and terrazzo floors, on Devu Road in Central. Grace suggested Nate try the Mapo eggplant in garlic sauce, a specialty. Fragrant, spicy, glistening. It was delicious, Nate told her. Grace had 2 glasses of wine at dinner, and coyly told him her Chinese name was Zhen, which means precious and rare. She wore a simple black dress, a double strand of pearls, and tiny pearl earrings. Her perfume was exotic and smoky. Nate had never smelled anything like it, and it lingered in his nose and mouth. She giggled when Nate threw her a bone, joking about growing up in a family of rapacious southern lawyers, priming the pump to get her to start talking about herself. Her history came out haltingly. She was an orphan whose liberal-minded parents, one a professor, the other an artist, were imprisoned during the anti-spiritual pollution campaign in 1983, the year she was born. She was remanded to a reluctant government-assigned foster family who received a stipend for taking the baby girl. She never saw her real parents again. She endured an unhappy adolescence, spent a lonely 4 years in a British university, and returned to a cynical, smog-choked China of new millionaires and a censored internet, an emergent superpower paradoxically caught in its imperial past. With an uncertain future, Grace went to hotel school, then moved to Hong Kong and prospered, eventually becoming assistant general manager at the peninsula. "How is it you went to university in Britain?" asked Nate. Grace lowered her eyes and sipped her wine. "I received a scholarship," she said vaguely. "Huh, not usual," Nate thought. Unless you have a patron who pays, or unless the state pays for you. There's a slightly false note here. Circle around and ask her later. "And the yoga?" asked Nate. Grace leaned forward, no longer defensive. Searching for comfort and company in a rootless childhood, 12-year-old Zhen spent hours in the back room of the neighborhood Zhongyi shop, that sold traditional Chinese medicines. The nut-brown old woman who swept the floor was a Bengali Indian, improbably stranded in China after a shipwreck, who whispered to the young girl, became her Xiaomyu, her godmother, and sang the ancient Sanskrit Vedic mantra, the Gairati, to her. The old crone was a yogini, a guru of the ancient practice, and began teaching Grace poses on the rough coir mats in the fragrant back room, lined with amber jars of preserved coiled snakes, yellow flasks of bear bile, and gray-dried lingzhi mushrooms stacked on shelves like cordwood. Besides its physical benefits, Grace in time discovered the abiding spirituality of yoga. It gave her serenity and made her melancholy adolescence bearable. She never stopped studying yoga, not even when she moved to Hong Kong. "So here I am," she said, tipping back her wine, accepting a third glass. She brushed a strand of hair off her face, softly bit her lower lip, and blinked at Nate. "No family, 14-hour days, nothing but my yoga to keep me whole." She took another sip of wine. "I don't know what the future holds." "Holy crap," thought Nate. "This is a psychological smorgasbord." He processed her story in parts, lingering resentment of the system, absence of communist ideology, strong work ethic and meticulous attention to detail, feeling isolated and disenfranchised and contemplating an uncertain future, and committed to and dependent on the spiritual aspects of yoga. This was an astounding collection of exploitable motivations right out of the textbook, almost too good to be true. A few more contacts, a sympathetic ear and a friendly smile, and he could subtly determine Grace's willingness to help him, her need to belong to a cause, her desire to give meaning to her life, to work toward a more liberal China. The case officer in him noted that she did not ask questions of him, which was a little strange. They walked after dinner in Central on empty sidewalks past buildings too tall to see the tops shrouded in fog. Grace linked her arm in Nate's. That mystery perfume washed over him, and he steadied her a little. They flagged taxi, which careered up Garden Road onto Magazine Gap Road to the front door of Grenville House, 15 stories of luxury apartments perched on the side of the juggly hill, looking over the tops of the high-rises on the next level below, slices of the harbor visible between the forest of buildings. Grace said the Peninsula Hotel paid her astronomical rent, otherwise she would be living in a moldy flat in Kowloon. Propriety in mind, Nate chastely bussed her good night on the cheek and was going to leave, but she spilled her purse on the lobby floor digging for her keys and giggled that she shouldn't have had that third glass of wine. Nate chivalrously rode up in the elevator with her and got her key in the door. She tilted her head and said he should come in to see how she lived because, after all, he seemed interested in her. "You are interested in me, aren't you, Nathaniel?" she drawled. "Okay, take this slow," he thought. Grace kicked off her shoes and led him into a large living room with picture windows and a herringbone parquet floor, without a stick of furniture or anything on the white walls. Nate cracked wise that he loved what she did with the room. The air was redolent with that same fragrance. Three large wicker baskets were lined up against the wall. At the end of the room, an immense gong from Tibet, Grace said solemnly, hung from a varnished standing frame, with a large white pillow on the floor in front of the dimpled 7-foot bronze disc. On either side of the gong were black lacquer console tables with matching Chinese cloisonné candlesticks, a deep copper bowl, and a squat black granite carving that Grace called Shivalinga, an idol to the Hindu deity Shiva, the patron god of yoga. "This is nothing less than an altar in a yoga church," thought Nate. Nate picked up the gong hammer, but Grace said, "No, not that way. I'll show you," and lightly ran the felt head of the hammer around the edge of the dimpled disc that started a low moan as the palpable vibration started, then were overlaid with a higher whine as the harmonics mingled. She dropped the hammer and shook herself, and Nate figured the whine had caught up to her, but she straightened and walked close to him, and he braced for either a kiss or a projectile puking, but in a small voice she asked whether he wanted to see Kundalini energy, her style of yoga, the coiled snake at the base of the spine. It was a little creepy. Nate remembered Bunty thinking maybe she was a bunny boiler, but she was tipsily offering to show him the wellspring of her soul after two dates, and he said yes, of course. The snake at the base of the spine, sure. Then things got weird. Grace took two steps back, unzipped her cocktail dress, and stepped out of it, the straps of the straining black lace balconette bra loose on her shoulders, and her boy shorts smooth between her legs. She sat on the cushion in front of the gong, folded her legs in the classic yoga Padmasana, and placed her hands on her knees. "First comes Kapalbhati, skull-shining breath," she whispered. She began slow, controlled breathing with deep inhalations and explosive exhalations. After a dozen breaths, she nodded to Nate. "Okay, make the gong sing," like she showed him, and the low Tibetan rumble started, and Nate could feel the buzz in his own spine. But he had to concentrate on a smooth circular motion with the hammer as the second sympathetic higher note started, and he looked at Grace, who was sitting rocking her torso in a circular movement, chin up and eyes closed, gaining speed, and she began an indecipherable chant at the same musical note as the gong. 4 minutes, 5, 6, shoulders in a circle forward and back, hands braced and eyes closed, and the sweat started pouring off her face and ran in rivulets between her glistening breasts and down her stomach to soak the waistband of her panties. Nate's arm was getting tired, but he was afraid that if he stopped with the gong, she would breathe fire at him and levitate off the balcony into the night sky. At about the 10-minute mark of unabated violent torso swinging, Grace leaned back, arched her spine off the wood, the back of her skull planted on the floor. Her sweat-transparent bra strained high, and she clasped her hands together in a Sapana mudra above her heart. She bent back even farther, her ribcage expanding like a bellows, her prayerful hands pressed between her breasts, and she started trembling. Tsunami spasms rolling up her heaving belly, the long muscles of her legs pulsing, her feet twitching, and her quivering chin pointing at the ceiling. She suddenly tensed, her eyes rolled white, and her mouth opened as she expelled a huge breath and lay still, hands now slack on her chest. Nate figured the telephone he'd used to call the ambulance was probably in the kitchen, but first he leaned over Grace, who was now lying flat on the floor, eyes closed, legs unfolded and outstretched. Her ribcage was still expanding with her breathing. "Are you okay?" he asked, putting his hand on her shoulder. Her eyes slowly opened and focused on him. She smiled, put a hand behind his neck, and pulled his mouth down onto hers for a hint of a kiss, a single caress of her lips. Her sweet fragrance enveloped him, and his head swam. "What is that perfume?" he said. She pulled his mouth down on hers again. "Ylang Ylang," she whispered in his ear. "He is very old." "Are you all right?" said Nate. "What happened to you?" Grace rolled to her feet, unhurriedly unclasped her sopping bra without covering herself, and walked to one of the wicker baskets, pulled out a linen kimono, and slipped it on. "What was that?" said Nate. Grace ran her fingers through her hair, then knotted the belt of the kimono, looking him in the eye without blinking, not at all embarrassed. "Awakening Kundalini," she said. "It's when I lose myself."
"Awakening what?" said Nate.
"Have you heard of the 7 chakras in the body? Life force centers?"
"No."
"I will explain it another time. It is too late tonight."
Another whisper of a kiss at the door, and Nate walked home along Bowen Road, mentally drafting tomorrow's cable for COS Burns's release on what appeared to be a notable start in the developmental to recruit Grace Gao, a.k.a. Zhen Gao. Nate's case officer antennas were vibrating a little, assessing factors. This was going faster than normal, maybe artificially faster. This Kundalini energy thing was unexpected. Could it be exploited? She had sobered up fast enough. She was an enigma, but irresistible, erotic without being salacious, alluring without being wanton, at once sophisticated and naive. If he could swing it, he had a feeling this could be an exceptional recruitment. The foreign scholarship in the United Kingdom was still an unexplained anomaly, as was her apparent uninterest in his personal history. These were false notes, but he'd resolved them. The MSS counterintelligence team in the apartment next door listened to the audio tape of the dinner at the China Club and reviewed the video of Zhen Yao, the poison feather bird's performance in the honey trap apartment on the other side of the bare wall, with the choreography of the gong and Matsuyana, the provocative bowstring fish pose, and the chaste kiss, and were satisfied with the evening and with future prospects for entrapping the American CIA officer and eliciting the name of his agent. His assassination was a foregone conclusion. The team leader politely congratulated their esteemed guest from Moscow, the beautiful blue-eyed Russian SVR officer who sat in an armchair in front of the monitors, bouncing her foot. Her guidance on how best to concoct Grace Gao's fictitious personal legend to inveigle the American was sibylline, almost as if she knew how he thought. Malpo eggplant and garlic sauce. Mix ground pork with rice wine vinegar, chili sauce, cornstarch, and soy sauce. Refrigerate. Cut Asian eggplant in half lengthwise, brush with peanut oil, season with salt, and broil cut side down on baking sheet until charred and tender. Whisk chicken stock with sake, sugar, sesame oil, bean paste, and soy sauce. Stir fry minced scallions, garlic, and ginger until fragrant. Add pork and brown. Then add chicken stock mixture and bring to a boil. Simmer until sauce thickens. Place eggplants cut side up on a platter and spoon over with pork. Garnish with sliced scallions. Serve with steamed rice. Chapter 29. Your Chakra is Showing. Dominica had arrived in Hong Kong several days earlier after a day of ceremonial courtesy calls in MSS headquarters at the Ministry of State Security. General Sun stayed in Beijing for consultations, so Dominica was turned over to an English-speaking captain of the Guangzhou MSS office named Yuan Chengguan. He had chosen the inexplicable Western business name of Rainy, Yutian in Mandarin, which was phonetically close to Yuan and lyrical, or so he thought. Rainy Chengguan was exceedingly short and thin, with all the built-in malignancies of the physical runt. He had the toxic temper of a low-level officer who one minute relishes mistreating subordinates and shamelessly toadies to superiors the next. He had caramel-colored teeth with stubby fingers with nails bitten to the quick. The halo around his head and shoulders was caramel-colored too, the color you get when the yellow of conniving treachery mixes with the browns of sloth and envy. Dominica knew she had to be careful around him. Colonel Dominica Igorova of the SVR was an alien being to Rainey. The leggy, busty Slav with the high cheekbones might as well have been from another planet. His English, learned at MSS officers' school, was just fluent enough to discuss strategy with her in the operation to trap the American. Rainey Chenghuan had, however, immediately seen that this Russian was held in high esteem by General Sun and MSS leadership, which meant he would butter her remorselessly. He moreover saw that she had long experience working American targets. Her suggested amendments to the entrapment phase plan, including tweaking Zhen Yao's personal history to appeal to the Yankees' operational instincts, were impressive. Anything that would ensure success and bring him credit and promotion was welcome. Rainey provided a translated copy of Zhen Yao's service docket for Colonel Igorova's review and suggested the two women meet to discuss nuances of the nectar bait. To his surprise, the Russian demurred, explaining that sparrows in the Russian service operated most effectively with fewer distractions. Rainey hurriedly agreed, complimenting the colonel on her foresight and wisdom. Zhen Gao's personal file was fascinating to Dominica. The autobiography she had recited to Nate was mostly fiction, with some nuggets of truth. She had not lost her parents, she was not adopted, and she never went to hotel school. She was never taught yoga by a wizened yogini when she was 12. She learned it only later as a way to stay in shape and help her seduce targets. Zhen Gao was the daughter of a minor state school teacher from Anjin in Hebei province, on the reed-choked shores of Lake by Yang Jian. Already a stunning beauty at age 16, Jian caught the eye of a provincial administrator who appraised the woman's body under the schoolgirl's smock. He used his influence to install the young girl as a housekeeper in a state-controlled villa, took her virginity, and occasionally shared her with other municipal jacks in the office to curry favor. When Jian was 18, the administrator was caught taking bribes and was tried, convicted, and executed for corruption. With no patron and an undeserved reputation as a pleasure girl, she was sent to Tianjin, a teeming city of 15 million on the northeastern coast 2 hours south of Beijing, and enrolled in State School 2112, a training academy run by the MSS that, the file obliquely explained, trained young women in intelligence techniques, which included seduction, elicitation, recruitment, and blackmail. Graduates were known as Ye Ying, nightingales. Based on academics, performance, and an assessment of ideological aptitude, a handful of nightingales were chosen for continued study at Institute 48 in Beijing, a classified facility in the northeastern Shangjialu district, where students were trained in the use of firearms, exotic weapons, and poisons. At age 20, Zhen was sponsored by a storefront Sino-Anglo Friendship Society controlled by MSS for the study of the United Kingdom, both to master English and to be exposed to Western ways. 4 years later, she graduated as a full-fledged seductress assassin of the state, known as Zhen Yao, the poison feather bird. Because of her excellent English and British manner, Zhen was quietly placed in a cover position as assistant general manager at the Peninsula Hotel in Hong Kong, available for assignments as required. Bozh, thought Dominica, reading the file. A young girl defiled by a swine, passed around the pigsty, then forced into the Chinese version of Sparrow School. Her pulse raced as she read Zhen's life history. It was like her own. But Russian sparrows don't kill people, Dominica told herself. But you have, haven't you? Throughout the second volume of the file, Zhen now was referred to as Zhen Yao. Dominica asked Rainey what a poison feather bird was, and he haltingly described the mythological bird with coal-black plumage that fed exclusively on serpents and whose feathers, as a result, were highly poisonous. One could stir a glass of wine with a single such feather to make it mortally toxic, he said. Only in China, thought Dominica. The file documented 14 assassinations credited to Zhen Yao, the most recent being a drug-dealing Burmese police chief who had been poisoned with a distillate of the monk's hood bloom. There had been no witnesses and no blowback connection to Beijing. Dominica turned to a pharmacological annex in the file that listed monk's hood as a poisonous plant that produces aconitine, a lethal tetrodotoxin readily absorbed through the skin. Even slight contact with the delicate purple bell-shaped flower would between 2 and 8 hours later induce cardiac arrhythmia, ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation leading to respiratory paralysis or cardiac arrest. Zhen Yao had applied the poison on the skin of the police chief, blended with ylang ylang, a fragrant essential oil used in aromatherapy. As she watched Zhen's kundalini demonstration on the surveillance monitor, the entire apartment was covered by cameras and microphones in the fixtures, woodwork, and ceilings. Dominica's heart stopped when she heard Zhen tell Nate her perfume was called ylang ylang. That's how they would do him. Zhen would dab him with fragrant oil spiked with the monk's hood toxin during some yoga tryst, which would kill him by the next morning. Would Nate sense the danger? Why would he? He was an operations officer on the hunt, intent on recruiting a beautiful Chinese girl. Benford and CIA had no idea of the threat. They couldn't warn him. Dominica herself was in a screamingly perilous position. She couldn't call CIA. She was in China. She couldn't throw a package over the wall of the U.S. consulate as it was surrounded by MSS lookouts. She was constantly accompanied by MSS escorts, and the diminutive Rainy Shenghuan was always at her side. They had put her in a luxurious guest apartment one floor up directly above this one, which Dominica had no doubt was also humming with multiple digital microphones and lenses, making it exceedingly risky to try to leave the building and somehow make street contact on the fly with Nate, who she also assumed was under MSS surveillance. If she acted to save Nate and made a mistake, the Chinese would report it to the Kremlin, and she would be lost. Dominica had tried to send Nate subtle warnings. She had advised the MSS that Zhen must not seem overly inquisitive and ask no personal questions, the mark of an intelligence officer. She recommended that Zhen downplay her UK university years by simply saying they were paid for by a scholarship. Dominica told her hosts it was safer to be vague, but in reality these were inconsistent notes that she hoped would be the silent dog whistle in Nate's head to get him to start smelling a trap. She also strongly advised that Zhen should mention Fernando's restaurant in Macau to shock the American into blurting something actionable, really knowing it would be a premature and aggressive note, sure to alarm Nate. She feared these would be too subtle, too diffuse warnings. Would Nate pick up on them? She couldn't try any more subtle sabotage, for the Chinese were too smart. Dominica didn't know how else to confound MSS plans to kill Nate. Grace had invited Nate back to her apartment for a home-cooked meal and repayment for the dinner at the China Club. She opened the door, smiled, and pulled him by the hand into the apartment. She wore a beige shirt dress that came to mid-thigh with floppy sleeves rolled up past the elbows. She briefly pressed up against him. He could feel the softness of her breasts under the shirt and kissed him lightly. She padded barefoot through the living room. The air was thick with ylang ylang, around the corner and into a small but modern kitchen done all in white tile and stainless steel. On the counter were a number of ingredients, a small black-handled Chinese cleaver.
"I'm making a Burmese tomato salad," said Grace. "The word for salad in Burmese is lethok. It means mix by hand."
"Were you ever in Burma?" said Nate. "What's it called now?"
"Myanmar," said Grace. "Only as a tourist. But a Burmese woman there taught me how to make the salad. Her name was Kisaw."
Grace chopped the ingredients skillfully, whisked lemongrass vinegar, canola oil, and fish sauce, then stir-fried sliced onions and garlic in a small pot of oil. Nate watched how she moved effortlessly around the kitchen, her hands quick and deft. She assembled the salad in a large wooden bowl, lightly tossed it with her hands until everything was incorporated, and handed Nate a fork. He tried a thin slice of tomato. The taste was salty, sweet, and pungent, with a slight crunch of crushed peanuts. "This is really delicious," he said. "I've never had anything like this before." Grace leaned on the counter and looked sideways at him.
"I think they serve a version of the salad at the restaurant in Macau," she said. "It's a little restaurant on the beach called Fernando's. We should go there sometime, and I'll show you."
Nate kept his face neutral. "Don't like the sound of that at all," he thought. "Coincidence? Maybe, maybe not." "Sounds like fun," said Nate. They brought plates of salad out to the balcony and ate while looking at the harbor and the scudding clouds and the night sky blushing pink from the city lights. "I find it inconceivable that this vibrant city was actually returned to China and is now under the thumb of Beijing," said Nate. "Do you think the spirit of Hong Kong can survive?"
"The people here are trying, resisting and demanding their rights. But I do not know if they will succeed," said Grace.
"I know the rest of the world hopes they will succeed," said Nate.
"So do I," said Grace.
"It would be a worthy effort to help Hong Kong stay free," said Nate. "Something with meaning." He stopped and came off the gas, putting it in neutral, not wanting to overdo the theme. They could come back to it at the right moment. Nate could tell her specifically how she could help. Work for CIA.
"I could see that," said Grace. "Right now I devote myself to the hotel, nothing else. And yoga is my only escape."
"I have to be honest with you," said Nate. "When you showed me that Kundalini awakening, I was a little startled, scared even. I didn't know what had happened to you." Grace laughed.
"Do you want to learn a little more? I can tell you about the chakras, the energy points in your body. They're very important. They control everything," said Grace.
"Okay, stud, keep this under control." Nate so far had kept things platonic, despite the black bra and the arched back and the cursory kisses. He could imagine Benford's reaction if it became known that he had recruited Grace Gao by bedding her. It would be an affirmation of Benford's lingering belief that Nate should no longer be employed by CIA.
He had not dwelled on it in some time, but now Nate contemplated what a nightmare it would be if he got kicked out of the agency and returned home to Richmond, Virginia, where his family all along had brayed that Nate wouldn't make it as a spook, never mind that his downfall took 10 years and not 2, as they had predicted. So how do you handle this Chinese beauty who wants to show you her chakras? They sat on the floor facing each other, cross-legged, knees nearly touching. Grace took the wide copper bowl off one of the altar tables, put it on the floor beside them, and struck the rim lightly with a small wooden dowel. The bowl gave off a clear, smooth note like the chime of a grandfather clock. "Singing bowl," said Grace, "to clear your mind." She ran the dowel around the lip of the bowl, which began a pulsing hum that grew into a second bullfrog tone, overlaying the first. She stopped stroking the bowl, and the tones slowly faded. She shifted herself slightly forward so their knees touched. "There are 7 chakras in your body, and they all represent different emotions," said Grace. She took a small bottle out of her dress pocket, unscrewed the cap, and tilted it forward to wet the tip of her finger. The dizzying fragrance of ylang ylang enveloped them, and Grace dragged her fingertip along the sides of Nate's neck, on the undersides of his wrists, and on his ankles. "The oil will help you relax," she said. She touched the top of his head. "This is the 7th chakra, the violet chakra, the crown which brings bliss." She leaned forward and kissed his forehead. "This is the 6th chakra, the indigo chakra, the brow, which controls intuition." She kissed his eyelids. "The 5th blue, the throat for healing." She moved lower and nuzzled his throat with her lips. "Jesus, she's heading south. Is there a Captain Picard chakra?" "The 4th green, the heart for love." Grace unbuttoned his shirt and kissed his chest. "The 3rd yellow, the solar plexus for purpose." Her lips grazed his stomach. "The 2nd orange, the spleen for desire." She ran her fingers around his navel. Grace moved her hand between Nate's legs and underneath his body, pressing up through his khakis on the fleshy pad of his perineal muscle. "The 1st, the root chakra, red, controlling passion," she said. She kept her fingers there and looked into his eyes. At a time like this, with Grace's ylang-ylang-infused fingers pinpointing his 1st chakra, Nate unaccountably and psychotically flashed to Kramer, his case officer colleague in Vienna, who once told him that the perineum was commonly called the taint because taint your balls and taint your butt. Nate wondered what that nugget was doing now. He shook himself as Grace removed her hand. "And when you awaken Kundalini," said Nate, trying not to squirm, "these chakras do what exactly?" "The energy expands from the root chakra, like an uncoiled snake, up the spine to the head, like an electrical current. It brings a profound consciousness." "I can feel mine expanding as we speak," said Nate. Grace scooted forward to sit on Nate's folded legs and wrapped her legs around his back. She put her arms around his neck and looked into his eyes. They were inches apart, from noses to crotches, and Nate could feel her body heat, like sitting too close to a wood stove. "This is called yab-yum, sitting like this," she said. "The union of wisdom and compassion." She took his hand, pressed it on her heart, and held it there. "Can you feel my heart? Let me feel yours." They sat motionless, eyes closed, hands on each other's hearts, foreheads lightly touching. "Now we cannot move for 1,000 years until we achieve samadhi," she said.
"Samadhi, whatever that means, is going to happen sooner than that," said Nate. "I'm just warning you."
"Stop talking," she said. "Samadhi is a state of mind. Concentrate."
Nate felt her breath deepen, and her heartbeat slowed, and he could hear it in his head, and he could feel his own heartbeat exactly matching hers. Her legs were wrapped tightly around him, her heels hooked softly into his back. Nate suddenly felt a lightness in his pelvis, his legs, his spine, and his arms. A loud rushing noise filled his head, as if he were in an underground grotto above a thundering waterfall. The lightness moved into his head, behind his eyes, and under his tongue.
"Do you feel it?" whispered Grace.
Nate nodded. Samadhi is wonderful, she said. It can carry you over mountains and across the oceans. What is over the ocean for you?